Time to take a look at your pet's health. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. And if you've got something ailing your cat or your dog, give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here. I braved the snow to get in here today.
Yeah, well, you know, we have a hard time surviving in that cold weather and so forth, but ticks apparently...
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, people need to realize that ticks don't die off in the winter. They just hibernate. They get down into the leaf litter, and they just hang out until warm enough weather comes. And I keep waiting for this snow to melt. But we have had tick blooms as early as late January, February some years when the weather just gets a little warm up into the 40s or so, and all of a sudden they'll come out and your pets will have ticks. So, you know, just don't forget about that. And if you're, you know, we do have a warm snap, get back on using some tick control, or better yet, even consider using it year round, which is what many, if you take your dog to doggy daycare or anything, they do require that usually to be used year round. But you know what? There was a study that somebody did it was kind of one of those fluky things. He did laundry and pulled out some clothes from the dryer, and there was a tick still alive on his clothes. And so this researcher actually took different species of ticks, including deer ticks, which we have in our area here that transmit Lyme disease, and put them through various wash cycles and so on. And what he found is that most of the deer ticks live through cold and warm water washes. So washing didn't destroy them. If they got into like your, you know, crevices of your clothes and things, they would just hang on for dear life and go through the spin, you know, rinse and so on. But when it came time to drying, all of the ticks died when they were exposed to high heat. So, moral of the story is you can have shrunken clothes, okay, and faded clothes, but you may not have ticks if you do it on dry, high heat in the dryers. So, you know, air dry, tumble dry, you know, not going to do it. So, yeah.
Well, you were telling me on a whole nother topic, you were telling me something that kind of disturbed me a little bit, some new FDA regulations for handling pet food.
Well, it's not actually regulation. It's their advice.
Advice
about handling it. So I get the terminology right. But what they found is, and this is not just, you know, raw diets, which I've talked about in the past, because we know raw diets, anything on the outside of the animal can be on the food, and we run into troubles with various bacteria, E. coli, salmonella, and so on. But what they found is, and their recommendations are, that if you are handling even commercial dog treats, biscuits, rawhide, you know, any of the commercial dog treats that are out there, if you give one to your pet and you've touched it with your hands, they recommend that you wash your hands for 20 seconds in hot and soapy water, which means singing happy birthday twice is what their recommendations are if you can't count to 20. Sing it twice after you've even handled a dog treat or any commercially available dog food or pet food, cat food as well.
Cat food as
well. Yeah, because salmonella is there and can be transferred on your hands to you. So, you know, it's kind of a little scary when I look at how I keep dog treats in my pockets and just hand them out willy-nilly. Just goes to show you that, you know, washing your hands is, you know, better for everybody.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And including yourself.
Yeah.
Edith in Madison has a question for you. So let's go to Edith. Edith, hi.
You are answer to prayer. Honestly, for days now, I've been at my wit's end. In August, I rescued an 11-pound toy poodle who the prior month in July was taken by his rescuers for oral surgery because his teeth were so bad in the lower right jaw. From that moment on, after all the stitches were there, he had refused to lap up water. He still will not lap up water, which means my vet says I have to provide a cup and a half of water a day, which means half a cup in his food if it's three times a day, or three-quarters of a cup if it's twice a day, which now he seems to want, and it makes his food so soupy he won't eat.
Oh.
And his urine is very dark.
Okay. I get really concerned about a couple things. I don't know what was actually done dental-wise, but if he had enough oral surgery done that he had stitches in his mouth, he probably had lots of extractions. And I worry about either that he's got still some open areas in there that haven't healed well, maybe root fragments that are causing some discomfort. And I think it would be a really good idea to take this little guy back to a veterinary dentist that can do oral x-rays, actually get x-rays of his mouth, just like we get taken of ours. It's, you know, it's a little, uses a little bit different equipment than your standard x-rays it would use for taking x-rays of an abdomen or a limb. So finding a dentist that can do this for you, a veterinary dentist, I think would be helpful. I really worry that he's painful, or that because he has had so much work done, maybe the fact that his tongue maybe falls out to one side of his mouth or something, that he's lost his ability to lap. I'd experiment and look at different temperatures, because sometimes cold water may be more irritating if you've got, you know, some dental pain. Warm may be easier for him. But yeah, something's got to be done. And I, you know, you got to rule out whether he's painful or not. So it's time to go back. And this has been too long, and he should be all healed up. We'll see pets that are totally gumming it with no teeth left in their mouth that can still eat even crunchy food fine. Oh, and so this is atypical. And
this is not typical.
Yeah. Yeah. You really need to get him back in.
Good luck.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Edith, for calling. John in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, John.
Good morning, Larry and Dr. Sandy. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question that's probably better suited to a animal psychologist.
Well, I'll see what I can do to help you.
All right, thank you, Dr. Sandy. It's about my Siamese cat. I've owned Siamese cats for better than 20 years. I currently have two of them, both indoor cats. And my beloved older cat, about 12 years old, has changed its attitude in about the last 3 months. Mm-hmm. You know, Siamese breed, they're very talkative, and they have a distinctive voice.
Mm-hmm.
This cat has all of a sudden gotten less affectionate, very talkative, but it's in an angry tone of voice. It looks at you and growls. It'll growl just around the house. It sounds like a pirate is running around my house. Also, occasionally I will hear it sound like, it's a female, and it sound like it was in heat.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm sure that this cat is beyond that that period in its life.
Is it spayed? Is she spayed?
Yes, she is.
She is spayed. Okay. All right.
And how old is she again? I'm sorry.
12.
12 years old.
Yeah. You know, any behaviors.
I think she's spayed.
Okay. Okay. All right. That'd be one thing to try to find out for sure, because, you know, you can see cats, you know, cycling right up until, you know, they're old ladies. So, you know, that's always something we want to rule out. But any animal behaviorist will always tell you, make sure that you have the pet checked out by a veterinarian for medical problems before you assume that it's strictly a behavior issue. When I hear 12-year-old cat, I think of lots of different conditions that can affect their personality and make them more vocal, grumpier. You know, some cats are actually, with the condition that I'm thinking of, can be more friendly, but you can see a whole range of personality changes. The one of very common endocrine or hormonal problems that occurs in geriatric cats is a problem called hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid gland. If you haven't had her in, it's time to take her in, get some lab work done, get a physical exam done, because sometimes you can actually feel a thyroid nodule. Have a look. Have the veterinarian should be listening to their heart. There may be a heart murmur or rapid heart rate. Get her weighed. Sometimes weight loss will be one of the symptoms that we'll see as well. But even with that, I've had cats in that I really was not expecting them to be hyperthyroid, and we get the lab work back, and it's surprise, you know, they are, and that could be causing some of their symptoms. So get that checked out. Also look for other things that could cause pain or discomfort. I think we really discount the fact that cats, you know, get arthritis, and we don't deal with it because we're dealing with dogs that go out on leashes, and we're walking them, and they may play a little bit more. For cats, we, you know, they lay on the couch, they maybe don't move as much, but they can experience pain just like we can or dogs can, and sometimes we have to do something about that as well with pain management. So time to, before you start looking at this as strictly a behavior issue, get her in for a good geriatric workup. Get her blood pressure checked as well, because sometimes that can make them crabby if they're hypertensive.
Yep. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling, John. Appreciate it. And let's take some more calls. Pat in Green Bay. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for making that trek into the studios today.
No problem.
I'm up at Green Bay where it's kind of nice today, but I have a question about our 10-year-old golden retriever. In about his second or third year, he was diagnosed with autoimmune syndrome. It has a very long name, and I can't remember it, but the muscle structure around his face and head have deteriorated.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what that is?
Well, they do get an immune-mediated myositis, masticary myositis. Yeah.
Yep, that's it. But I had a specific question. Over the years, the vet just treats him with prednisone, you know, a real common steroid, to kind of knock it out of him when it flares up.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't really had a flare-up in about 2 years.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if we will see less and less of these flare-ups as he gets older, if we may see it more often, or if there's any new treatments besides just giving him a cheap old steroid.
Yeah, well, steroids are definitely helpful for immune-mediated diseases when you use them at the appropriate dosages. This is a really interesting immune-mediated disease. The muscles that are used for chewing, the muscles of mastication, actually have a different embryological development than the other muscles of the body. And so they're recognized as a different class of muscle tissue than, say, the muscles on your legs or your arms. And so for some dogs, their immune system will start to attack these muscles. And we actually have a blood test now that we can do that looks for immune markers to indicate whether we're dealing with this disease or not.
Hmm.
Most owners don't even see the acute phase of it because dogs are pretty stoic and they may not show any changes. And with all the hair on their head, you may not see the slight swelling that may occur or the discomfort. They just continue to eat and carry on. It's not until they come in for a physical exam and the veterinarian looks at them and go, what happened? You know, all the muscles on the top of your dog's head have all atrophied. I've never seen this happen, but it's reported that some dogs that have this to a very severe degree may actually have enough scarring that they may have difficulty opening their mouth.
Oh, can I comment on that?
Yeah.
On the initial outset on this, when he was young, it was so bad he could not eat. We were wondering why he couldn't eat.
Ah.
And even under a general anesthetic, the vet could not pry open his jaw. That's
how
bad he was.
Wow, wow.
Yeah,
because most dogs, it's diagnosed kind of after the fact. The muscles are atrophied, and it's already past the point where we can do a whole lot. So if your dog still has residual muscle left, then yes, there could be flare-ups periodically. And, you know, as to whether there's anything better, I don't know if anyone's done any research on using cyclosporine, but that is one of the drugs that we're using for a number of different immune-mediated type problems, but steroids are still the classic drug that we use, and when used correctly at the right dose and on a decreasing schedule, you really have very few side effects. It's when you get, you know, the animal hooked on it and we're using it day after day that we can run into lots of serious side effects.
Right, and that's exactly how our treatment's kind of been running its course off and on over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for your comments. We're just happy to get 10 good years out of it.
That's great. That's great.
Okay.
Thanks, Pat.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And here's another caller, Rick in Eau Claire. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning, Larry, and good morning, Dr. Sawchuk. I have a 9-year-old golden retriever mix female that over the last 2 to 3 weeks we have noticed that when she is standing on all fours and you look directly over her back, on her left side of her body, it's swelling out in the chest cavity probably about the size of my palm.
Huh.
It's not hard like a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem to cause her any pain. And, in fact, I actually have a appointment set up tomorrow to take her into the vet because it seems like it's getting bigger.
Okay.
And I'm just curious what I should be looking for. I mean, in the spring, all her heartworm tests and everything came back negative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just kind of curious. It just showed up.
Yeah, any new lumps or bumps that a dog or a cat gets should be investigated, no matter, you know, how slow or how fast they're growing. I just had a cat in the other day that had a little tiny bump on its head, and it turned out to be what's a type of tumor called a mast cell tumor, which for cats usually isn't that big a deal. Dogs can be a fatal type of cancer. And so anytime you see something different like this and you've got a swelling on the chest wall, most likely it is some type of growth. I doubt that the other side is atrophied, that you've got, you know, it's actually the side that's bulging out is the side that has the problem. The most common tumor that can occur on the chest wall of aged dogs is, good news, it's a benign growth called a lipoma or a fatty accumulation. They're usually anywhere from, you know, tiny, I've had them as, you know, small as maybe a half inch around, to the size of a grapefruit on, or bigger, on a dog's body. When they occur on the chest wall, sometimes they will be underneath a muscle belly and it flattens them out. But these will feel kind of soft and squishy. Easiest way to get a diagnosis is to have your veterinarian do what's called a needle aspirate or a needle biopsy. Just take a fine needle, they'll put it into the mass, collect some of the cells, blow it out on the slide, and if you're lucky, your veterinarian will tell you that all it is fat, and that there's nothing to be concerned about. These tend to be more cosmetic than anything for most dogs, unless they occur in places like the armpit, or I had a dog in the other day where it was right on their breastbone or their sternum, and every time it laid down, it bumped it, and it got inflamed, and so we needed to take that one off. But for the most part, it's just one of those things where keep your dog fluffy, and you won't notice them as much, and then she'll probably get more if that's truly a lipoma, but get it checked out, and I'm glad you're going in tomorrow.
Well, she's always had, I mean, ever since she was probably 3 or 4, we've always noticed, you know, a little lump or something would grow here and there, and we've had them checked out, and it's been nothing.
Yep.
But we've recently, in the past year, gotten a new puppy because I had to put my 11-year-old gold or yellow lab down, so we got another puppy, and this was way more activity than she was used to.
So yeah.
I was kind of concerned that maybe, you know, in the rough housing that she might have, you know, drilled herself into a bush or something and ruptured. But if you look straight down from her, she looks like a tire that's just got a bulge on it.
And so I it's very, very unlikely that it's anything. I mean, if it was a foreign body or there was something in there, she'd be running a fever. You'd see a draining hole. She'd be probably a sick dog. So the fact that she's happy and playful, hopefully it's nothing. But call us back.
I mean, she still eats. She still does everything else normal. Just all of a sudden this bulge showed up.
Yeah, but you're doing the right thing getting it checked out. So good for you.
Good luck, Rick. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Stephanie in Madison, your turn. Hi, Steph.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Hey, you bet. And boy, I'm glad you had this. Dr. Sawchuk, thank you for being on today.
You're welcome.
You came just in time because we have three wonderful cats, and our oldest one is Jackie, and she is about 13 years old, maybe a little. Yeah, 13. We got her from after one of our other cats died. The emergency vet clinic, the vet there offered us Jackie that was at the night that our other cat died. It was the sweetest thing. So she's a wonderful cat. But lately we've noticed that, my husband, he's kind of the mom of the cats. You know, he really nurses them and really is a great observer. But I'll try to summarize here. In the last maybe almost 2 weeks, she has had coughing, and kind of wheezing. It comes and goes. It's not constant. There's an occasional sneeze, we really don't know quite how often it happens, like throughout the day. I mean, I suggested that we could even, like, you know, kind of like really watch her and like write it down during the day, write down her symptoms and stuff. She eats well. She's active. A couple days she's been kind of, you know, a little mopey, but, you know, I thought maybe it could just, you know, we didn't know if it was related to what was going on or if it just, you know, some kind of an energy cycle. But it's, basically wheezing, and even sometimes when she purrs, the hacky cough.
Okay.
And the occasional sneeze.
Okay. Yeah, I sound like a broken record, but You need to get her in to have her looked at. What I worry about, there's a couple of things I worry about. One is we do see cats developing asthma. It would be a little odd to be a 13-year-old cat, but sometimes they can have very, you know, minimal signs of it. And this is the perfect time of the year for it to happen. People are bringing in live Christmas trees. You've got your house closed up. You've got forced air heat. You've got a fire going. Lots of particulate matter in the air. And that can trigger this. The other thing that we can see, and this would be, again, the perfect schedule for it to be developing right about now, is heartworm disease in cats. And it's actually been called heartworm-associated respiratory disease in cats, HARD.
Wow.
Okay? And it's they present with asthma-like symptoms usually. Cats, you know, if she got exposed this summer, it takes about 6 months to develop. And as the immune response is occurring, it can cause lung changes. And so I think a couple things you need to do. One, call your vet for an appointment. And two, explain to them her symptoms. If you can get it on video, even better. If you can ever, you know, catch
really?
It, that would be helpful, because sometimes we don't see it and we're trying to figure out what's going on, and it may be helpful. They will do a thorough physical. They'll listen to her. They'll probably recommend getting a chest x-ray done as the first thing.
Okay.
Next thing they may consider doing is a heartworm test, which is a little bit different than we do in dogs, but it's still basically the same kind of thing, drawing a blood sample. And then depending on what they find on that, they may be recommending that they do a tracheal wash or something called bronchial alveolar lavage to collect some of the material and see what's going on in there for cytology and culture. And so it sounds like a lot of stuff going on, but you may catch it with just even just getting a chest x-ray done may be able to help you. So,
Now, we've never allowed our cats to be outdoor cats, but they could probably just from sitting in the windows, I suppose, get, you know.
Yeah, I mean, heartworm disease here in our state for cats is pretty low odds. But there was a study that was done out of North Carolina where they showed that cats that had heartworm, a third of them were diagnosed as being strictly indoor cats.
Wow.
And so that's kind of interesting. Although when you look at statistics here, cats get it at about 5 to 20% of the rate that dogs do. So a lot less common than it is in dogs. And then you add in the fact that they're staying indoors, that even drops it even more. So it'd be very unlikely. My guess is that there's something else going on with your cat's lungs to cause the wheezing and coughing, and that's what the x-ray is going to help find out.
Oh, thank you so much.
Good luck.
All right.
All right. Thanks for calling, Steph. Paul in Duluth, Minnesota, it's your turn next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, and boy, do I want to congratulate everybody there for showing up during an ice storm. We don't have ice up here, just snow. I was talking to the screener, and I just caught the very end of what you were talking about with the gentleman with the lab with you called them like they could be just like fatty deposits.
Mm-hmm.
I have a soon-to-be 15-year-old chow mix, and she has she's had this what I always thought was just a pimple. I mean, it's been there for as long. I've had her since she was about a year old.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like on the side of her neck. And what I noticed the last time I bathed her, because her fur is so thick you can't see it, is that this thing has grown. It's about the size of an acorn.
Okay.
And now she's going into the vet in January for, you know, her biannual checkup.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just wondering if that could be that same kind of a fatty. I didn't hear the whole conversation.
Yeah. Usually lipomas or these fatty growths are under the skin. They're not visible on the surface of the skin. They occur between the body wall and the skin. So you feel them underneath. They may move around a little bit. What you're describing sounds like it's actually something in the skin, which could be a growth of some kind, maybe a type of tumor, maybe benign, could be malignant if it's growing, maybe a cyst. There's a whole host of things that it could be. The fact that it's on the neck where a collar may rub, it may be that it's
It's actually, even with her collar, it's I guess it would be more towards her shoulder blade.
Okay. So it's not being irritated, but
oh no.
Yeah. Again, this would be something that your veterinarian could look at, do a needle aspirate of, just like we did with the lipoma dog that we recommended to have that done, and find out what it is. And, you know, just looking at the slides, whether they want to do their own cytology or send it to a clinical pathologist to have a look at it, that's, you know, that's up to them. Many benign things are very easy to diagnose, and they may be able to get an answer right there. And you know what? I really liked hearing the fact that you're going in for twice a year physicals with your dog, because that's what we recommend. Remember, pets age faster than we do, and so when we're going in for our annual physicals, you know, that's, it's real important that we consider getting that done more frequently, especially as pets get older. And a 15-year-old dog, lots can change, so twice a year physicals is a great idea.
Well, she's got a real nice birthday present coming. I don't know exactly what her birthday is, but since I got her in February, it's always Valentine's Day.
Oh, okay.
That's great, Paul. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. All right, Valentine's Day. Let's go to Kathy in Grafton next. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning, Larry.
Hi.
Hi, hi. Dr. Sawchuk, I have a question. I have a cat who appears to act a little dumb, but, you know, pretty normal until after, you know, like I come home, it greets me, it goes to the scratching post and scratches, and then it goes to the walls and starts to lick, and will lick the walls.
Ah.
And I'm just wondering if there's any deficiency in this cat.
Oh, very unlikely. You know, I had an old cat, and his name was Marmalade, and he did the same thing, and I had this whole clean streak right across where it was licked, you know, it was a stone, an old house with stone wall in the entryway, and he loved to lick that, and I don't know why, but it was, and so sometimes we will see these kind of behaviors that you wonder what started it, and it may be something as simple as he went over there, there was something on the wall, he licked it, you gave him attention, and now that's all part of the greeting, attention-getting program that he has devised for himself. I really doubt that there's a plaster or paint deficiency in your cat's diet, you know?
My daughter was, you know, brought up maybe pica.
You know,
where adults will eat clay because they have a deficiency of some sort.
And right.
There's something in the paint that...
And it's possible, but, you know, this would, again, if your cat's not losing weight, it's urinating normally, stool's normal, hair coat looks good, it's on a well-balanced commercial pet food.
Right.
Very unlikely that there's any problem. And my guess, it's just one of those fluky things that started for some reason and has just been perpetuated. And my guess is that you probably do pay attention and ask, you know, even if it's negative attention where you're saying stop doing that, he's still getting what he wants from you. So what I would recommend is before he even gets to the wall, try to head him off at the pass by finding something else to distract him, whether it be throwing a cat toy, having a toy on a string or a wand, his favorite treat, so that instead of greeting you, scratching, running to the wall and licking, it's greeting you, scratching his post, and then chasing after his little toy. And that may help save the repainting that may need to get done with that rough tongue.
Oh, thank you very much for calling, Kathy. Marmalade, eh? That's a nice name for a kitty.
Yeah, he was an orange cat. He died many years ago, but he was a sweet boy.
Let's go to Eric and Augusta next. Eric, hi to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. My brother... Actually, I'm calling for him. He has a 7-year-old boxer, and I don't know if his problem is behavioral or maybe health-related. He will drink a gallon of water, as much as he can fit in him, walk 10 feet and throw it up, and go back and drink some more if you let him.
Wow.
He will drink and drink. If he gets outside and there's a mud puddle, he'll stand in that mud puddle and drink and go and throw it up and go drink some more.
Wow.
And
well,
you can stop him, you know, you'll say his name and he'll quit drinking and he'll be fine.
Yeah.
But if you're not watching, he'll go right back over and start drinking some more.
Well,
and he does suffer from separation anxiety.
Okay.
He now lives in the semi with my brother.
Okay.
He gets lots of walks, exercises, good commercial dog food, regular water and stuff. But we had him at my house for a while, and if you're not home, he will actually go through a window.
Wow.
We found him on a roof one day.
Wow.
He went out of the second story window.
Wow.
He can't handle being with all people.
Yeah.
That's why I wondered if there's something health-related or if it's a behavioral thing, an anxiety thing.
Yeah, I think you need to rule out a health problem. He's a middle-aged boxer, and what we would be wanting to look at, I actually have a list that I give to students that are my top 25, I think it's 25 on the list, differentials for dogs that are polyuric, polydipsic, which means drinking more, urinating more. And sometimes it's just drinking more. And if he has easy access to outside, you may not even realize that he's going to the bathroom more frequently. There's a lot of different things that we look into, but probably some of the top ones are kidney disease, diabetes, Cushing's disease, which is an overactive adrenal gland. Those are going to be the top things that you're going to be wanting to rule out. And that's easy enough to do by taking your dog, or your brother can take the dog into the veterinarian, explain what's going on. If they can bring a urine sample with him, preferably in the dog's body, okay? Meaning that short leash, don't let the dog be lifting its leg on the trees outside the clinic, so they can collect a sterile urine sample. That would be very helpful. They'll probably want to get a little blood work done too. If it comes back that there's nothing wrong with the dog, I've been a vet for, almost 30 years now, and I've had very few cases of what I would call psychogenic polydipsia, which means a psychological problem causing the pet to drink more water. I had my first one in that I truly do believe it is that. It's responding very well to Prozac. But a dog that just in this last year that we, in fact, I just filled its prescription a couple of days ago. So that's not a common problem. But, get it, rule out medical things first, and then you start thinking about, is this actually a behavior problem? And then there are things that we can do to try to, redirect him and give him some other things in life. And it could potentially be, if that's what he does to relieve anxiety, part of all his separation anxiety business. But if he's doing it even with your brother and when he's with people...
Even in the truck. He has a jug he can just reach over from his seat, and he fills his bowl up.
Okay.
He can only put about a cup in the bottom of it. He'll lick the bowl right clean. Stand there and want some more.
He needs to be checked out. So urine and blood, good physical exam, and I bet they're going to find something wrong medically with this dog.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you.
He weighs about 90 pounds.
Cool. Yeah. He's a big boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Terry and Tomahawk, we are going to you next. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 3.5-year-old golden retriever, female, spayed, who developed something with her eye. Her symptom was that she had lateral strabismus. It was in the right eye.
Okay.
And she wasn't able to look forward at all. Took her into the vet several times. He thought probably it was a myositis of the eye muscles, a cellulitis of the eye muscles, maybe causing some inflammation that she couldn't bring her eye to medial position. Tried her on antibiotics, a short burst of low-dose steroids. It was only 10 milligrams. After the steroid use, after we started it, it seemed that she could bring her eye a little bit towards midline, but not very far, never to normal. And the third eyelid is way up.
Okay.
As we've doctored with this over and over, she went to a veterinary ophthalmologist.
Good.
She did not find anything mechanical with, she didn't find anything with inside the eye globe itself.
Okay.
The retina was okay. She did try, she anesthetized the eye, and she tried to pull on the muscles to see if she could bring the eye to midline, and she could not move those muscles.
Huh.
So she put her on steroids, and I think she called it an autoimmune-mediated myositis, which is what somebody earlier talked about. And mega dose of steroids, I think 130 milligrams for 2 days, give her a big burst, and now she's on 65 for 10 days, and then 30 for 10 days.
Okay.
But during this whole course, we've seen a little bit more movement of the eye, still nothing to midline. It doesn't look normal at all.
Okay.
Although she's able to catch a treat now, which she couldn't do initially.
Okay.
So it must have come back a little bit enough that she can...
focus, yeah.
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 But in this course, she has developed a right posterior leg limp. With exam, seems to be painful in the knee.
Okay.
At the time the ophthalmologist did her exam, there were no swollen lymph nodes. Now she has a swollen lymph node on the right.
Wow.
Then after he put her on clindamycin, thinking it was maybe Lyme's related, that the prednisone had backed off her immune system enough that the Lyme that was kind of sitting dormant kind of got going. Nothing with the clindamycin didn't do anything for her, like, limp. She still limps on it. Worse in the morning than evening. She won't step on it in the morning.
Wow. Oh. Wow. Big, very complicated case. And, you know, I start worrying about whether this is, you know, the steroid use, whether we've now got a ruptured anterior cruciate, which is probably one of the more common things that we'll see in golden retrievers. And that would be something that could be diagnosed through palpation and sometimes x-rays of the leg if she's painful over her knee. So, you know, getting her in, I know it sounds like another specialist, but to somebody that knows orthopedics, and any veterinarian that works in the small animal realm has, I know that all the students I've taught have all been trained how to evaluate the knee and be able to evaluate x-rays. So you may not even have to go to a specialist to have that done, even back to your regular veterinarian. This is not something that I'm going to be able to, you know, just say, here's what's going on. But it sounds like if she's got that much going on around her head that they can't figure out what's happening, and now she's got lymph node enlargement. I'm hoping they're doing needle aspirates of her lymph nodes to determine whether she's got lymphoma or some inflammatory changes in her lymph node. They may want to be looking at getting an MRI or a CT scan done of her skull to look for muscle changes, masses, or something like that that could be affecting around the eye and causing some nerve issues. Boy,
there's a lot there.
A lot here. And it may be time to gather up all your medical records, including those from the ophthalmologist that you went to see, and see someone who specializes either in internal medicine or neurology, orthopedics. I'd start with internal medicine. And that would be like if you went to someplace like the veterinary school, you'd start out in that department, and then we walk them down the hall and go, hey, what do you think of this? And we have the neurologist look at them, and then you go a little bit further, and then there's all the orthopods. And so that's the one advantage of going to a big referral center, whether here or or all over the state now. They're going to be able to help you. So I think it's time to go back to square one again.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Terry. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Pleased to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Kate in Madison is next. So let's go to Kate. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a curiosity. I walk my young golden doodle in a little woods off of the bike path on the west side of Madison, and I run into a lot of other people and their dogs. And lately I have run into three different dogs with two different people who are eating the bark right off of oak trees and chewing it up and swallowing it.
Wow.
And, you know, I've been around dogs for 55 years, I guess, and I've never seen this before. The first one I ran into was an older poodle, and the man said that, you know, the dog had started doing it as an older dog. He had no idea why. You know, he said I feed her, and I feed her really expensive dog food. And I thought, well, it's just this dog. And then 2 days later, I ran into a woman with two, like, middle-aged goldens, and they were doing the same thing.
Huh.
And I looked at all the trees that they were going after, and they were all
oaks,
large oaks.
Okay. Yes. And I'm wondering if there is either animals living in the top and urinating or defecating, or animals that are urine marking the trees that are attracting them to the area. You know, my own dogs, not that they're go out and chewing on oak trees, but I do have oak firewood that I carry in for my wood stove in my living room, and they have decided that that's the best chew toy. And I've been finding, like, logs on the sofa.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are bulldogs, and they're not the smartest anyways, but that's, yeah. So I don't know why. That would be very odd. I mean, a lot of dogs like to pick up sticks and chew on them.
Sure,
but why they're attracted to those particular trees,
Well, the bark of those trees, the bark of an oak is
kind
oak.
Of spongy.
You can get your, you can get your teeth into it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's
it does,
easier to pull off.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does come off more easily, as I know, on my bed and on the sofa and so on.
Well, and I was curious whether there could be a mineral there or something that they're going
out. Yeah, again, I doubt it, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, if they're on a well-balanced diet, why would they be all of a sudden wanting to go to that? So something's attracting them to it. And mm-hmm. what it is, I have no idea. You need to, you know, set up surveillance cameras and see what wildlife is out there at night to, you know.
Oh, can't answer that one, Kate.
Sorry.
But it's an interesting question.
But if anybody has any ideas, call back. That yeah, let us know.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks for calling. Sarah in New Berlin, you're next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have two cats, 1.5 and about 2.5. And in the last month or two, I have found that one of them has urinated on my couch at least once. And then I had a jacket that was laying on the floor, and I picked it up, and it was all wet, too.
Oh,
I have no idea which cat.
Okay, yeah.
I suspect which cat, but okay. I don't know.
Well, this is the problem because, you know, all we always say, got to rule out medical problems first. Do you have a bladder stone or bladder wall irritation or something that could be causing some problems? But, you know, if you don't know which one, do you get both of them checked? You know, good question. But I always go back to, you know, got to get medical things ruled out, but try to figure out which cat if you can, and then start looking at litter box management. And kind of rule of thumb with litter boxes is Sawchuk's rule of litter box management. If you have two cats, how many litter boxes do you need?
I was told three.
Three? Do you have three?
I actually went back to, I have two, and it's always been fine.
Okay.
And I clean them religiously.
Okay. But, you know, three is the recommended number. Okay, so we want to add another one in.
Okay.
You also want to have them in three separate locations. Putting them together in the same room is like building your dream home and having all the toilets in one bathroom. Doesn't serve the family a lot of good. So spread them out because
okay.
your cats are you know, in that socially mature age where there could be some social conflict. You may have one that's very passively aggressive that just kind of lays next to the boxes and says, go ahead, make my day, try to get in here. So you want to have them in places where they have good escape potential, not near major appliances like furnaces and water softeners and things that can scare the cat when they start up. And at least one extra than you have cat numbers, especially when you have a problem. Then we start looking at litter box design. Open pans are what is recommended for cats. And boxes, I always use the analogy of going to the state fair and hitting a porta potty on a hot summer day. You know, they're small, they harbor odors, you may be cleaning them frequently, but it still doesn't matter to the cat. And if you've got any social grief between the cats, one climbs in the box and they can't get out because the other one's blocking their way, or they may be too afraid to use the litter box because they're afraid the bully may follow them there. So uncovered boxes are recommended, and the litter box needs to be at least 1.5 times the length of the cat's body from nose to butt. Okay, so some of our big cats that we see, the standard litter boxes that you're going to find at pet stores don't work. I have three cats at home, and I've actually gone to using the translucent blue rectangular storage tubs that you can buy at any discount store, and I throw the lids out, and I use those as litter boxes. They cost about $4 or $5, and I can get rid of them after a year or so because sometimes the plastic will even harbor some odors. Don't use liners. Cats don't like to have liners in there. It's kind of like using those tushy protectors when you're at mm-hmm. a public restroom, you know? Not very comfortable. And scoopable litter is what is most cats seem to like, but you may have to experiment and find out if there's something else that they like better. And so sometimes giving them a smorgasbord of litters may be helpful as well. So that's just kind of a, you know, a little rundown. You also don't want to have the litter boxes near where they eat. So, you know, separate food from litter boxes. And but, you know, if you can't find a medical problem, start working on ticking away all those changes, management changes, and hopefully you'll be able to get under control.
And good luck.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Patty in Ellenton, your turn. Hi, Patty.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Excuse me. I have a problem. Of course, we're going back to food now. I have a 10-year-old Malamute that my dogs have gone on a high-protein diet because I had lost a cat to this all this China stuff. And my female, once she totally got on it, I took a month to switch them over. She started having accidents in the house. So last week I took her to the vet, and they did a urine analysis, and she does have high, she has crystals in her urine.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of the high protein?
The crystals are usually from minerals, and it may be that the mineral composition of the food may be inappropriate for your dog, or it may be something as simple as they took the urine sample, let it sit on the laboratory counter for over half an hour.
No, minerals... because that's one thing that she asked me when I went back in, is how long it was. And I went to the vet's office, got their little container, took her outside, and boom, they took it right away.
And they took it and they ran it right away.
Yep.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and that, so you may want to look at getting an x-ray done to see if there's bladder stones or anything starting there too. It may be something to do with the pH of the urine that you've unmasked a problem for your dog with the current diet that you have it on. It's interesting that you brought up the melamine issue. There was just a report looking at the AVMA journal reported just last week how many pets actually died in the United States from the melamine episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they, of the reported confirmed cases, there were 143 fatal cases in cats in the country.
Mm.
There were 92 cats that were non-fatal cases, 83 dogs that were fatal, and 29 dogs that were non-fatal.
Mm.
So, you know, it wasn't as common. I mean, yes, those are horrible statistics. We don't want to have anybody, you know, have their pet die of this disease. But actually, when you start looking at numbers, my guess is there probably was more that just went unreported. But, you know, and so perhaps the food that you're feeding your dog is inappropriate. And, you know, I think that if you were happy with what your dog was on previously, it may be worthwhile going back to that and then segueing into a different diet if you feel that you really do need to make a change. But I think, you know, right now, pet food manufacturers are doing everything they can to try to, you know, make sure that the food is safe, and you're better off using something like that than trying to formulate your own diet, which may not be well balanced.
I'm really not formulating my own diet. She's on a granular high protein with raw.
Okay. So.
Oh, Chris, I just went brain dead.
That's not. Yeah.
No.
But you know, it goes back to this old thing: how much grain should they have in their food, which right now they're really not getting any.
Yeah, and that may be affecting the pH of your dog's diet, and that may be what's causing some more of the crystal formation. But what I'd recommend is getting another urine sample checked and see if this was just a one-time fluky thing. So,
yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Patty. Appreciate it. Les in Madison, we turn to you now. Hi, Les.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have three adopted female cats. One was about 6 years old when I got her, and the other two I got as kittens. They all been neutered. The two young siblings were neutered somewhat late, maybe about 18 months. And they're indoor cats, but they had an incident last fall when they were on the screened porch in by the back door. And there must have been another cat in the neighborhood, because they suddenly became very aggressive toward each other. And one of my pathologist colleagues suggested that they might have become very fearful of another cat outside and were displacing their fear aggression toward each other. The odd thing that's happened since then is that the two younger cats seem to not be able to get along anymore. The one that was lower on the totem pole is no longer able to tolerate being around the other one.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if it's possible to try an over-the-counter pheromone treatment or
Good for you for recommending. Yeah, thinking about that. This happens sometimes. You know, something will startle a cat and they'll take it out on their housemate. And it's called redirected aggression. And it may be, you know, due to any number of things from, you know, I've had one cat actually of my own run into trouble with getting a paper bag caught over his head and went running through the house and ran into another cat. And the two of them that loved each other were then, you know, very much fearful of each other because it's like, oh, is this going to happen again? And so anytime they would see each other, hair would get raised. And I had to separate them for a few days to let them get chilled down again and then gradually expose them to each other to, you know, we're in nice, safe conditions where nothing bad was going to happen. And then they became comfortable with each other. So you may want to back up a little bit and do that. Separate them. Let them see each other during non-stressful times, such as maybe meal times. Let them see each other through the crack in the door and go from there. But one thing you can try is feel away or comfort zone for cats, which is the facial pheromone. Comes in a spray or an atomizer. Natural calmative for some situations like this. Is it going to help? Who knows? Is it going to hurt? No. So I think it's always worthwhile trying.
Yep. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take some calls now for Dr. Sandy here on the Ideas Net, and Brett in Green Bay is up next, so let's go to Brett. Brett, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 2-year-old dog who was vaccinated in last year, the summer of 06, for Lyme disease, and she was overdue on her booster, and this just a couple weeks ago then, she went in for a, she had a pre-anesthesia blood screen, and it showed that she was positive for Lyme disease. So we followed up with that with a quantitative C6, I think they called
good,
it.
Good, yes.
And her levels were elevated. I think it was like 150, and anything over 30, I think, was supposed to be significant.
Well, you just have this all down. Yes, okay.
Well, here's the problem. She hasn't shown any symptoms at all. I mean, we never would have done anything if, you know, she wouldn't have gotten that pre-anesthesia blood screen. So I'm trying to, you know, weigh the pros and cons of treatment. And I know in humans, I think that you would treat for any infection, you know, regardless of symptoms. And I don't know how that applies to dogs.
We can see what you're talking about is there's a very quick screen test that we can use that looks at, it's called C6 antibody level. And the C6 antibodies are produced by the real disease, not vaccine. Okay. So it differentiates exposure versus vaccine. And when we get that quick, you know, little snap test back that just says yes or no, there's C6 antibodies there or not, you don't know whether it's significant level or not. And as you said, your veterinarian followed up with a test called a quantitative C6 antibody level, which is a test that gets sent off usually to a lab in Colorado that actually gives us a number. And we know that when it's less than 30, that's probably just background noise and it's nothing that probably needs to be treated or be concerned about. Greater than 30, then we start worrying that we've got something going on. And we know that this test can test positive before the dog starts showing clinical signs. So my recommendation is if the value is less than 30, the antibiotics are cheap and safe. It's doxycycline usually, which is a synthetic tetracycline that we use, that it's worthwhile doing. But what you need to do also is follow up 6 months after going through treatment for a month and have another quantitative C6 antibody level done. What we'll see if our treatment has been successful is a drop by greater than 50% in that level. So we recheck again and see if it's dropped down. If it hasn't, we've either had an owner not give the medication or the dog's probably been re-exposed. And so we get a little worried about that. I think it's an easy enough thing to treat when we start knowing about chronic joint complications and so on. It's you're talking about a $10 prescription of an antibiotic for a month. So go for it.
So the side effects of the doxycycline aren't too bad?
No. No. Okay. No. I mean, it's in cats a little different because they have such dry GI tracts that you have to follow up with a water chaser when you give those pills. Dogs take it down in a meatball or whatever. I mean, yeah. They'll swallow anything. Cats, you have to give a little water afterwards. They don't see the humor in having that done. So
let me see if I have this straight. It's to give it for a month, and yep. then you wait six months beyond mm-hmm. that.
Yep, and then recheck again 6 months later. Because it can take a while for the level to drop, but that's what we're looking for is a drop in the antibody level.
Okay. Yep.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. Joel in Ludington, Michigan, it is your turn. Hi, Joel.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a toy poodle, and I just want to bring up one little quick issue about the oak bark.
Yeah.
I cut wood, and sometimes they have four or five different types of bark laying around in the yard. And this dog will root through all of them and pick up a piece of oak bark, and he will chew them.
Wow. There
he
must
just likes it for some reason. Yeah. I think because he can really, like you said, sink his teeth into it, and he can just tear it up.
It's a little spongier. Yeah.
Yep, he likes it. But anyway, he has a problem with his left hind leg.
Okay.
He seems to favor it. He seems to want to limp on it. Sometimes he'll pick it up. But when he's occupied and he's into something, he runs around fine, like there's nothing wrong with it.
Okay.
I've squeezed it. I've, just massaged it and checked it. And he doesn't seem to have any pain in it. And I just, at one time, one of the kids pulled him up from under the couch. Because, when you say, what have you done? He wanted to run under the couch.
Uh-huh.
Well, he messed one of his dew claws up. So we had all his dew claws removed.
Okay.
And I'm starting to think that it's almost in his head.
It's a toy poodle. The two common orthopedic diseases that we'll see in small breed dogs, probably the number one thing is a luxating kneecap or a kneecap that's slipping in and out of the joint. Most commonly in poodles, we'll get what's called a medial luxating patella. And this would be something that on feeling the joint as you bend and flex it, you actually may feel the kneecap pop out. And this, when you've got your dog in for its physical exam with your veterinarian, ask them to check the leg out and see what they think about that. If it's something that's, an intermittent problem where it pops out and he has to wiggle his leg around and hop on it for a second and then it goes back in, sometimes we don't even have to worry about surgically repairing those. But if it's spending more of the time out of the joint and it's bothering the dog, then going in and surgically correcting it may be indicated for your dog's quality of life. The other thing that we'll see in small breed dogs is a condition called leg Perthes disease, which is a problem with the head of the femur or the ball of the ball and socket joint that makes up the hip. And it'll become flattened and irregular shaped and can result in arthritis that, again, may bother the dog at certain times. And when he's occupied, again, he just forgets about it. But when he's, just sitting there and paying attention to it, it may be bothering him. So, again, that might be something that on palpation your veterinarian could feel, or it may be worthwhile even getting some x-rays done to see if something like that's going on, because that is, again, something that can be surgically corrected. If it's a minor problem, your dog may do better on some type of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory if they can tolerate those, not a human one, but you'd use something that you would get from your veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, to bring this up with your vet, and I bet it's either the knee or that hip. Knee probably most likely.
Okay.
Thank you very much, because I just want to know if it could be some kind of a medical situation.
Yeah.
So we will definitely set him up an appointment, because he's well worth it.
Good.
Thanks, Joel.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Thank you for calling. Dan in Montford, your turn next. Hi, Dan.
Hello. There are a question about dogs. I know it's in the summertime. They eat grass periodically, and what I've heard is because they have upset stomachs, if mm-hmm. that's correct. But I'm wondering in the wintertime, this time of year when they can't get to the grass, if there's something I can give my dog to help her, if that's why they eat the grass for an upset stomach.
Well, interesting that you bring that up. I don't have the article with me, but I got asked to do an editorial comment on an article on grass eating in dogs, and they actually did various studies to look at how many of these dogs actually had medical problems and how many of them just ate it because they liked it and then vomited because it was a little irritating, but not vomiting because they needed to vomit. It just happened to go along for the ride because it was irritating. It comes down to a lot of dogs just like a little salad now and then. And some grasses are just tastier for them. My favorite picture that I have of my pets is back when I had a Yorkie and my tortoise and a cat. They were all outside in the backyard around the bottom of my daughter's slide, where, of course, the rain would accumulate and the lawnmower didn't cut. Yep. And so the grass was long there. All three of them were chowing down on the tall grass there. But the only one that was a vegetarian was the tortoise. And none of these pets had any health problems. So some dogs just like to do it. If your dog is nauseated frequently, then again, I wouldn't be looking at, well, what can you give your dog? You got to find out why your dog is getting sick so frequently, and rather than trying to give them something to make them vomit. I have seen dogs eat houseplants. You have to be really careful about that because some of them can be toxic. They may, lick the carpet and do things like that if they're feeling nauseated. If your dog's doing any of those behaviors, then by all means, get them in and try to figure out why your dog has got an upset tummy and see what they can do about it.
Well, I think she just likes it because, like you said, the longer grass, it seems like that taller quack grass around the edge.
Yeah.
I'll just pick it and I'll feed it to them just throughout the day. And they grab it from me and they like to eat it up. So in the wintertime, there's probably, if there's nothing you can give them, or?
Well, I've had some people will give their dogs like chopped up romaine lettuce that the dog may like. But I think if they're on a well-balanced diet, they probably don't need anything like that.
All right. But you could try some lettuce
if you want to. Sure.
Why
won't
not?
Hurt. Yeah.
Carol in Wausau, your turn now. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling.
A few months ago, I adopted a 4-year-old miniature dachshund female. Very sweet little girl, but she has absolutely no idea how to play. I have a 10-year-old male who plays with balls and chases and shoots at stuffed toys. She just looks at him in bewilderment. Is there anything you can do to...
Yeah, I had a Yorkie, the same thing. She was adopted as a young adult, and we don't know anything about her background. But my guess is when we have dogs that don't have strong play drive, it's probably because they were not raised in an enriched environment as a youngster. The fact that she was a 4-year-old dog when you adopted her, whether she was a, breeding animal or, a dog that...
She was a companion to a woman who was very ill.
Yeah, and so maybe she never got played with. Maybe she didn't have toys to play with. But that's all learned behavior very early on in life. And I know... when I had my little Yorkie, how disappointed my daughter was because we would go to pet stores and we bought everything to try to find something that Electra liked to play with. And no, that's nothing appealed. She just didn't want it. She wanted to be with us, and that was her entertainment. So, you can try and see if there's something different that your dog likes that, with my two dogs at home right now, one likes things that make noise and squeaks, and the other one likes these Nylabone keys and a tennis ball. And so they're very... distinct preferences, even in my own home, between two dogs. So you may just try going shopping at a pet store and seeing if something catches her eye. Some dogs do like to shop.
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
Good luck, Carol. Thank you for calling. Marie in Stevenson, Michigan. Excuse me. Marie, hello to you.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Okay, this is in regards to earlier when you were saying that the rabies shots were good for, a more extended time than what, a year goes. So my question is I had two dogs, and this past October, the one dog went to attack the other dog and tried killing him. The long and short of it is I had that dog put down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had him for too long. He was just too aggressive. And the other dog was very, it was on IVs and stuff. But they said I could have him in 3 days, but then they said no, I couldn't because they had to quarantine him for 10 days to check for rabies. And then the dog I had put down, they told me that they had to cut off his head and send it out to get it checked for rabies. Mm-hmm. And I always keep my animals current on their shots.
Yeah.
So what is the reason for that?
Yeah. Well, there's a number of different rabies quarantine requirements, and sometimes it depends on whether it's an animal biting a human or an animal being exposed to another animal. And let's just talk about the animal biting a human being.
Well, it happened. I got bit too.
Yeah, and so that's right. So if a dog bites a human being, even if they are current on their rabies, we have no guarantee that that the animal responded to the vaccine. Maybe they were sick when they got it, didn't respond well. You know, so you don't know whether they're well protected or not. And so because rabies is a fatal disease for people, the recommendation is if you have a pet, at least in our location here, and it can vary from community to community. In Madison here, if an animal is current on the rabies vaccine, the quarantine can occur at home, but they have to have three checks at the beginning, middle, and end of quarantine. What that's for is that the animal may be shedding rabies in their saliva, but not showing symptoms of rabies for up to 10 days.
Oh.
So it can take a while before they start showing neurologic signs. So that's why they're kept, you know, at home, away from visitors, and not out in the general public. If an animal is unvaccinated, now we're dealing with a higher risk patient that could have a higher risk of having rabies. In our community, that requires the animal to be isolated in a rabies quarantine facility, which is a veterinary clinic. And that way they can be watched on a daily basis with minimal handling for that 10-day period of time. If after 10 days they're neurologically normal, then it can be released back to the owner again. So if we are going to be euthanizing an animal that has recently bitten somebody and you're not going to be fulfilling the quarantine requirements that your locality requires, then by law, we have to have the animal checked for rabies. So your options were to keep the dog alive for 10 days and then euthanized and not have it checked for rabies. In this case, you opted to euthanize before the quarantine was up, and the brain had to be sent in to be evaluated. The reason why they do this is for public health reasons. They're looking out for your safety, even though your pets are current on the rabies vaccines. What a horrible experience for you to go through. I'm so sorry that it's such a stressful thing. But there's a method to the madness behind all these laws, and it's to keep the general public healthy.
Yeah, I just wondered because it was like the one dog was 7 that I had euthanized, and the other one was 8. And, you know, they've always been up to date on their shots.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I could see if it was a puppy, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You answered a question.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for calling, Marie. Let's go to Jessica in Madison next. Jessica, hello to you.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cat who passed away yesterday.
Oh,
sorry.
He had been having, for the past week, he started having seizures, and where he would sort of flail around and then urinate on himself, and then he would come back to seeming completely normal and being affectionate and eating fine, and everything seemed fine. And we took him in this past Tuesday to the vet, and they tested his blood pressure, and they did some blood work to look for organ failure stuff, and there was nothing that came out from it. Like, everything was completely normal.
Did they look for any infectious diseases like feline leukemia, FIV, toxoplasmosis?
They hadn't done those yet because they were like, we'll just send out for the regular organ stuff. And then he had a couple other seizures, and we were about to get them to do those other tests.
Mm-hmm.
And we got home last night, and he had clearly had another seizure and was paralyzed and then died on the way to the emergency.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
This, you know, we don't see epilepsy in cats as often as we do in dogs. And by far, more cats have infectious causes. But older cats, things like brain tumors can be triggering it. Vascular accident. He's only 4. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if you'll ever find out. When there's unanswered questions like this, having an autopsy done, although it may not seem like something that you want to have done immediately, believe me, down the road when there's questions like, should we bring another cat into our household? Did we have something infectious? Is it something I could have prevented? There's going to be all those unanswered questions.
Right.
Having him checked, if that's possible still, I do recommend it. And that's, in a case like this where you weren't unable to complete a thorough workup, I mean, ideally the cat would have had an MRI done of its brain and it would have had some infectious disease screening and a full neurologic exam. You just didn't have time. And
that just happened so quickly.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Do we need to be concerned about our other cat?
Well, that's why having an autopsy done is going to be able to answer those questions for you. If this
right.
was something infectious, then by all means, it could be something that your cat, if it's immunocompromised, could have been exposed to, and you'd know what to be watching for symptoms for your cat. So if you still have your cat's remains available, getting them to, you know, your veterinarian to have an autopsy done is
would make sense.
That it really does make sense.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank
good
you.
Luck.
Yeah,
I'm very sorry.
Luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah, that's always a tough thing.
Yeah.
Terry and Abrams, will give you a chance now. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon to you both. I've got a little female calico cat that somebody went and dumped off here where I live in a rural area, and she was roughly, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months old when I, you know, when I obtained her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been in and out of heat. I've been trying to place her in a home, but I still have her. Does it hurt? Right now she's in heat. She went in heat about a day or two ago. Does it hurt to have her spayed while they're in heat?
It's a little more difficult for the surgeon because when they're in heat, there's increased blood supply to the uterus. And so you have to be a little more careful about removing the uterus and the ovaries, which is what is being done when they are spayed. So, you know, but there are many times where we have no idea that the cat's in heat. You get them opened up and it's like, whoop, they're in heat. Well, you spay them anyway. So as the veterinarian knows ahead of time, they just know they may have to make a little bit bigger incision, add a couple of extra stitches in, maybe a couple of extra ties on the, you know, on the uterus to be able to have it removed. And, you know, a good surgeon's going to be well prepared and be able to, you know, she'll be
take
able to recover from this just without any problems at all.
One more question. How long do they usually stay in heat? Is it kind of in and out a lot?
Yeah, that's cats are what are called induced ovulators. They're very different than dogs. Dogs usually come into heat a couple of times a year and then go out of heat for an extended period of time. Cats save their eggs, and they don't ovulate until they've been mated. And so they'll come into heat and wait, and if they don't get mated, then they go out of heat. And in and out, usually every couple of weeks. It's very light dependent, and so as the days start getting shorter, the nights get longer, you'll find that cats will stop coming into heat, which is why it's hard to find kittens around Christmas time, because in the fall, cats stop usually coming into heat. But cats that are housed indoors that are exposed to a lot of artificial light, they could cycle all year round. So you may find that all year long, she may be cycling. So I think you find it, you know, it sounds like she may become your cat. So just for your own sanity, getting her spayed, I think, would be a good idea.
I already have 5. I don't need any more.
You don't need another one. Oh, well, she found a good kitty home then. So
thanks for calling, Terry. Good luck. Appreciate it. Tim and Plover, hi to you.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What can we do for you? Got a quick question?
Yeah, I have a 2-year-old Boston male that likes to lick everything. It just licks everything. And I don't know if that's a health problem or if that's a behavioral problem.
Yeah, you know, and it probably is a behavior problem, unless your dog's got some dental disease or something that's causing them to move their tongue and be uncomfortable. Probably like that cat that we talked about earlier that licked the wall, most likely just a behavior issue. So trying to redirect it to something that you don't mind. I had one owner that had to taught their dog to lick a hockey puck. That way they could wash it. It was small, and the dog would lick that and leave everything else alone in the house. So be looking at it as more of a compulsive type behavior problem.
All right.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Sandy, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew by.
It does. Hour and a half. Already gone.
And you are going to come back and be with us again.
I think in about a month. Right.
We'll see you next year then.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Sandy. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. She'll be back next year in January, and we'll talk with her some more about your pet's health. Really some interesting things today, especially the suggestions on pet food and washing your hands even after handling pet treats was something that I hadn't heard, so I was glad to learn about it. Coming up tomorrow, we'll take a look at phenology on the program. Dennis Prusik of Green Bay talks about his 2008 Wisconsin Nature Calendar. And then at 11:45, pleased to welcome Victoria Houston of Rhinelander to the show. She's a favorite author of mine. She writes the Loon Lake Mystery Series, and we'll talk with her about that series tomorrow. Stay with us. Lots in store.